This is The Guardian.
Today, on the eve of the Glasgow Climate Conference, the view from a country vanishing underwater. In 2009, around the time of the COP summit in Copenhagen, the world heard from the president of the Maldives, the lowest-lying country on Earth. Mohamed Nasheed made an urgent plea for help, with estimates that 80% of the Maldives could be uninhabitable by 2050.
Please, ladies and gentlemen, we did not do any of these things. But if things go business as usual, we will not live, we will die. Our country will not exist. We cannot come out from Copenhagen as failures.
12 years later, Nasheed has been to prison, survived an assassination attempt, and watched global carbon emissions continue to soar. And we're on the edge of another COP, this time in Glasgow. And Nasheed has a new message. Not save the Maldives. Save yourselves.
You know, I was previously thinking about our own vulnerability. But now, I kind of think, sitting in front of them, how silly you are. If you want to protect your way of life, your livelihood, you must change. It's no longer, oh my God, it's going to happen to the Maldives and these small islands, we would lose them. No, it's not that anymore. You're going to lose. France is going to lose. England is going to lose. Germany is going to lose. The United States is going to lose. We are all going to lose. Look at it. There's fire in tundra. Forests are burning. There's floods everywhere. We can see it. And I think the science is very, very clear. And we must understand the gravity of the issue. It's not just the Maldives.
Over the next 2 weeks, countries like China, the US and the UK will try to tell us what a successful climate agreement looks like. But the stakes are highest for the Maldives and a few dozen other countries who are the most vulnerable to global heating. And they're coming with their own demands. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in focus, former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed on what success would really look like at COP26. President Nasheed, can you start by painting me a picture of what the Maldives was like when you were a kid?
I'm very old now. I'm 54. We were the first generation to actually see the reef because goggles and these kind of things came to the Maldives in the late 60s, early 70s. I grew up in it and went snorkeling and diving. And we are also the first generation to actually see the thing die.
That is such a dark irony, getting the ability to see the reefs only so you can watch them die. When did you start to see those kinds of impacts of global heating on your country?
I think we started seeing signs, unusual patterns, late 70s and early 80s. Imagine the Amazon forest or the Congo forest just disappearing.
Coral reefs don't just look great in holiday photos. They also contain more biodiversity than any other ecosystem on the planet. So it's essential that they don't disappear.
We are now living at a 1.2 degree planet. The waves are stronger, the wind is stronger, the rains are more, the summers are longer, the ocean temperature is increased, coral is bleaching, and the reef is therefore dying. And when you lose your reef, that acts as a water breaker to the shoreline, you have coastal erosion. We have coastal erosion problems in more than 90% of our islands. Maldives has over 2,000 islands. And to protect 1 meter of shoreline, we are spending $5,000 a meter to build a water breaker. Now, just imagine this is a meter. We don't actually have that kind of money for shore protection. And the loss of biodiversity because we are losing the reef means that we will lose our fishery industry as well. We lose everything. We are losing it, and we are losing it very, very rapidly right in front of our eyes. That's living in a 1.2 degree planet. So if you take that above 1.5 degrees, it really would be a death sentence on the Maldives and a number of other low-lying countries.
And Mr. President, you use the words death sentence. Is that how stark this is? Are we talking about life and death for a country like the Maldives?
I think we need to understand the gravity of the issue, how serious this situation actually is, not just to the Maldives. Germany had flash floods and lost over 200 lives. Same thing in Belgium. And it's happening all over the world. The IPCC, in their last report, clearly connected carbon emission to the bad weather. And we can all see the bad weather. And I think we are talking about a quarter of the world's population that would face disaster if we continue along business as usual, as we seem to be doing now.
In 2008, you were part of a democratic revolution that overthrew the Maldives' authoritarian leader, and you became the country's first legitimately elected president. But you immediately found yourself facing another crisis. That was the warming climate and its impact on the Maldives.
Half of Ilias's house has been washed away. This used to be my bedroom, he says. What am I going to do? The island is getting smaller. Even new houses aren't immune.
How much longer do you think this island can be inhabited?
Not more than 20 years.
What did you decide to do? What ideas did you have to try to make it clear to people that you were in an emergency?
In 2009, the UN climate conference was going to be held in Copenhagen. So we had a cabinet meeting underwater to suggest that this is what it would look like if we continue as we are doing.
A cabinet meeting with a difference. The president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, and 13 other politicians donned their scuba gear and headed to the bottom of the sea. They communicated using hand signals and whiteboards. Those who took part had trained for 2 months.
If Maldives cannot be saved today, we do not feel that there is much of a chance for the rest of the world. Everyone saw the picture, and I think people realized what we were trying to say. But of course, people have not yet mended their ways to make sure that we survive.
That year, you did something else that was groundbreaking, an announcement of a policy that seemed really radical at the time, but which is now a mainstream demand.
Now, the president of the Maldives announced this week that his country aims to be the first in the world to go carbon neutral. That would mean meeting all its energy requirements through renewable sources such as solar and wind power.
The carbon neutral idea is more to do also with economics. Renewable energy is now more financially viable, and therefore for countries that are laying out infrastructure afresh, it is far more sensible to have renewable energy. You can have a development strategy with less extraction and more recycling. You can have the same economic outcomes, GDP growth, high employment, low inflation, but still extracting little and recycling more. You can have a good life, I believe, without damaging the planet. When we first said that we were going to become carbon neutral in 2020, countries thought we were mad. But thank God, people seem to have now realized that this is the only way that we can proceed.
Since 2009, your attempts to address this issue have been pretty dramatically interrupted. You were effectively removed from office by supporters of the Maldives' old regime in 2013.
With the police and military accused of helping to carry out a coup, this confrontation was never going to end well. The first rounds of tear gas fired at supporters of the now ex-president, Mohamed Nasheed.
And a few years later, you were convicted on very spurious terrorism charges. And in fact, during the 2015 COP summit in Paris, you were in a jail cell. Now, thankfully, you were able to seek asylum in the UK, and the government that jailed you was voted out. And now you're back in politics, the Speaker of Parliament. But just a few months ago, you were the target of an assassination plot. An IED was detonated as you got into your car outside your home.
Our top story this hour, Parliament Speaker and former President of Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, has been injured in a terrorist attack near his residence. According to reports, Islamic State has taken responsibility for the attack on Mohamed Nasheed.
Firstly, are you okay?
Well, I was just listening to that. I was just wondering who you're talking about. Yes, true. It's a long story. Physically, I am fine. I can now run. I can walk. I am doing my exercises. I am fine. I was in for medical treatment in Germany and England for the last 5 months. I have just returned back to the Maldives and we are getting ready to go to the COP. Things have been good and things have been bad and things are again good. And I think we will have to keep on trying winning against the odds. And I'll give my best shot.
We were all so relieved to see that you survived that attack and that you're back working. And I wonder if your story might tell us something larger about why it's so hard to focus on this urgent climate crisis, because it's a kind of slow apocalyptic problem, but the world doesn't really stop for us to address it. There's still so many other terrible things that demand our attention. I wonder, how do you stay focused on this issue and how should we?
I believe that this is the single most serious matter for our generation and for many generations to come. And I also believe that it's doable. We can save the planet. And I think if we continue unrelentingly, then people do listen to you. It is now becoming an election issue, and political leaders would find it difficult to get re-elected if they do not give enough care to the planet and do not have green and resilient policies. I think if you take Britain, for example, and the Conservative Party, for example, what a U-turn they have made, and beautiful to see that. And I think a lot of other center-right political groups have changed. Even if you try to sell a coal plant to someone, people won't buy it anymore. Good that China said that they're not going to sell it abroad anymore because no one is buying it.
President Nasheed, we're talking to you in Mali, and I'm really interested about the atmosphere there. I mean, given how stark and how desperate the forecasts are about the climate crisis, there have been a lot of radical solutions proposed for the Maldives, things like relocating the population. We're already seeing work on building up defensive walls and trying to reclaim land from the sea.
Mali, the nation's capital, is at least surrounded by a 3-metre-high wall to break the forces of incoming waves.
And I'm wondering, do you still see something like mass migration as the future for Maldivians?
You know, I see a quarter of the world's population on the move. And if you do not have high ground, you are bound to get on a boat. You know, I myself am a refugee twice. If your roof falls upon your head, if you are shot at, if you have water up to your neck, you're bound to jump on anything that would save your life, and you're bound to leave. Will that migration be orderly? I don't think so. Now, will the people of the Maldives leave? Can we find enough adaptation measures to see that their roof doesn't fall over their head? I think that's our challenge. And we are talking about bigger embankments, reclamation, raising the islands. And the last has been a floating city. And I'm hopeful that this technology also has meaning. I don't want to go. I don't think many Maldivians would want to leave the Maldives. But when they have no high ground, they will leave.
These are such confronting scenarios we're talking about, and they're ones that Maldivians have been living with now for more than a decade. I'm just wondering, emotionally, how do you and how do your people deal with and process what your country is going through and what the forecasts say about it?
There's a sense of hopelessness. The last few weeks, the weather has been very bad, and we've lost people, lost to the sea, lost to the waves. This is an island nation, and yes, we lose people to the sea all the time, but it's a lot more now. And we're losing property also. We're losing houses. We're losing land.
hundreds of palm trees lining the coast have already disappeared.
Every day, a small bit is lost to the waves as trees and palms are brought down. Once the trees are gone, the beach doesn't have the power to protect itself anymore. What's left here now soon will be washed away.
There is a big sense of loss, but I'm always trying to come out with a more optimistic picture than be burdened with the pessimism.
Coming up, what the most vulnerable countries in the world are demanding from the COP summit. President Nasheed, in 2009, you banded some of the most vulnerable countries on Earth into a bigger group, places like Vietnam, Ghana, Barbados, Kenya, into something called the Climate Vulnerable Forum, also known as the V20. What was the point of getting those countries together?
You know, when I first went to the COP, one of the things that I saw was that big emitting countries were using debt as a leverage, as a disciplining agent. And I felt that we need to articulate our own view of what is happening to the vulnerable countries, and usually countries that have not contributed to the change in the climate, but are suffering the most. So a few of us agreed in the Maldives that we would come up with a forum. And fortunately now, we are 48 countries. And with the regional discussions, we were able to combine all the six regions and then come with one statement. And that would be the Glasgow Dhaka Declaration. And I think there's a number of other countries who want to join in. Now, again, this is becoming mainstream. Germany is climate vulnerable. France is. England is. Everyone is. And I think that is a thinking that all countries now must take on board.
Well, let's talk about the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. We're right on the eve of it now. And in tangible terms, what are the particular things that the Maldives and other climate vulnerable countries will be asking for? What are your demands?
I think most importantly, 1.5 degrees, that countries agree not to heat the planet above 1.5 degrees, counting since the Industrial Revolution. If countries come up with plans and legislative agendas on how to decarbonize. If countries come up with procurement orders that would push you to a low carbon economy, I think that kind of thing would give more confidence. We would also ask countries to submit their NDCs, nationally determined contributions, every year, not every 5 years. And we would also ask countries to have more ambition the coming year than you had this year. We would also be asking countries to give us a delivery plan on the funds pledged for adaptation, the 100 billion. We also would like to see that that money is audited through the IMF with vulnerable countries sitting on decision making in it. And I think we also would like to ask debt holders to restructure the debt. And if we are able to get some headway in these four areas, I believe that we can come out and say that COP26 was partly a success. But if we don't, I think we're losing faith in the UN system, in negotiated settlements, in discussions, in the international order.
Yeah, I mean, if that system and that order can't solve a problem like this, you've got to wonder, I mean, what is it for? One of the things here you've been talking about is this $100 billion fund that wealthier countries would give to others to help them adapt to the climate crisis. What do you think that money should actually go towards? What kind of things should it be spent on?
I think it should be spent on nature-based adaptation. It should be spent on finding a resilient coral that would survive the climate change different scenarios. I think it should be spent on getting a sand grain that would retain more water, and so hopefully we would not have the mudslides. I think we should spend that money on rainwater harvesting, I think we should be spending on nature-based adaptation, not on the same concrete again. And I think we should be also spending half of that on mitigation, which would be renewable energy and other sources of fuel.
So that would be half on adaptation, half on mitigation.
Yes.
The other part of that that I think is really interesting is you talked about the way that wealthier countries sometimes bullied poorer, more vulnerable countries using debt. They use debt as leverage, and you have a plan for how that debt should be restructured. Can you tell me about it?
Most vulnerable countries are heavily debt-ridden, and they're paying some 20% of their budget on debt repayment, while they have to pay another 30% of their budget on adaptation. Now, this just can't go on. These countries will go default soon. We think that the money that we owe to debt holders are firstly too much because the prices of many of these projects were heavily inflated. Secondly, these assets created by the debt are now under stress because of the bad weather. You know, we took a loan to build a road, to build a hospital, to build a house. The bad weather is destroying the road, the hospital, the house. So, you know, assets are stranded. And to ask for the money now, your pound of flesh, is, I think, very wrong. And also, when we took the debt, IPCC did not tell us that the bad weather would be upon us tomorrow, but they said it's going to happen in 50 years or 100 years' time. So I think there's a clear legal and moral and an economic rationale for debt restructuring. We are asking debt holders to swap some of the amount to a resilient climate change project. For instance, if we owe $10 million to a debt holder, will the debt holder agree to spend $7 million of that on a climate resilient project in building a reef, in planting trees, investing in renewables? So that's the debt restructuring, debt swap idea, view that we have, and we would like to see some headway in the COP.
COP will run over a couple of weeks, and during that time, there's going to be lots of official sessions. We know the first few days will be political leaders presenting their emissions reduction ambitions. And then each day after that will be centered on a particular theme, transport, energy, finance, and so on. But then also on the sidelines, there'll be things like dinners and events and informal meetings. And I wonder how you'll be using all these different opportunities to press your case.
I think you should have dinners and cups of teas and try to foster conversation and understanding. I'm not going to sit there and get this done through the tedious UNFCCC negotiation process. This is the 26th COP. Do you know, the last time I went to the COP, it was very lovely. I found negotiators have got married to each other and we have COP children. They're beautiful children, but we have not found solutions through the negotiations. We need to get out of this framework and find an agreement.
That's interesting. So you have doubts in the kind of way this whole negotiation plays out. I mean, you think it could be structured in a different way or could play out in a different way to make it more effective?
Definitely. You know, right now, it's all about the process. So little about the substance. It's like the WTO negotiations. Two countries agree on something and a third country comes along and disagrees. Then you reduce your ambition to accommodate the third country. You would then be ending up with the lowest common denominator, and that's not going to save your planet. I think you need the highest common denominator. And I think willing countries should go forward and should go alone and should set an example and display the advantages of the new technology and the new methods and the new world. Leave the others behind.
President Nasheed, you've been raising the alarm about the emergency situation that the Maldives faces now for well over a decade. And in a few days, a delegation from the Maldives will be sitting around a table with delegations from giants like the US or China. And you've got this incredibly powerful moral argument. How are you going to really ram that home and make sure these bigger countries care enough to finally make the changes that we know are needed?
I think we have to find their own mindset, not to talk from the increasingly very disadvantageous position that I am in. But I think we need to portray that they are having more disasters, that they are losing more money, that their livelihoods are in danger, and trying to be conservative and not change things might not be the smartest thing to do. And you cannot always be pretending to be leaders. If you are a leader, you have to go out there and lead. You have to take your people along with you. I am hopeful that they will understand it because they themselves, they are feeling the heat.
So in 2009, it was about save the Maldives. In 2021, it's about save yourselves.
Yes, exactly. In 2009 also, I did say that if the Maldives sink, Manhattan will. But they did not listen.
Are there any particular moments over the course of these 2 weeks that we should be looking out for? Things that might give us an indication of how this summit's going?
Well, I think high-emitting countries coming out and giving an NDC that would keep us below 1.5 degrees. My sense is that they would add the numbers together and say, bingo, we have 1.5. But the technical details of how to get there might be lacking. And also, I think they would say that we are going to spend the $100 billion. And these two would, in a sense, make the COP look reasonable.
President Nasheed, in light of all of that, the stakes are just so high. This meeting is potentially our last chance to avert catastrophic global heating. How are you feeling about COP26? Just how important is this moment?
Well, you know, it's a strange moment for me personally because I've just come out from the brink of death. And I feel that there must be a purpose. And I do not want to see a situation where the planet cannot be pulled back from the brink. I hope that people will understand the gravity of the issue, but I do see the lethargy of the people getting used to this disaster environment and talking more about adaptation than mitigation. You know, it is strange to see how suicidal we all are. But I think we can pull back from the brink. I just hope that we can, as God has allowed me to, live again.
President Nasheed, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed. Many thanks to him. That's all for today, but we have a ton of COP coverage coming over the next 2 weeks. The COP meeting is an opportunity to save the planet. I'm not exaggerating. It's that important. And The Guardian is going to be all over it, with daily in-depth coverage at theguardian.com. I'd also really recommend you go and subscribe to Science Weekly. They're going from a weekly podcast to a daily one throughout the summit, so keep an eye out for that. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We're back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.